Speaking of health, swine flu is back. Schools and colleges around the country are already seeing outbreaks of the H1N1 virus. Officials expect it to become more widespread over the next several months. Not long ago on this program, we talked about the disproportionate impact swine flu might have on minority communities. A recent study out of Boston found that last spring, the rates of hospitalization for swine flu among African Americans and Latinos was twice that of the population overall. We talked about the theories of why that might be. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Howard Markle. He's a professor of pediatrics and medical history at the University of Michigan and an advisor to the Centers for Disease Control. We're also joined by Dr. Marilyn McPherson-Corder. She's also a pediatrician and associate professor of pediatrics in Washington, D.C. We're going to speak with them about what can be done about the disproportionate impact on minorities. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Doctor, just to recap the issue, when we talked to researchers out of Boston about why there was a disproportionate impact on minority kids in Boston during the first outbreak last spring, they said it has nothing to do with the virus itself. So can you just talk more about why, what we know so far about why this disproportionate impact occurred?
Well, I've seen here in the Washington, D.C. area, perhaps a correlation with, at that time, we had tons of asthma and asthmatic-type symptoms, and as a result of that, with the outbreak of the H1N1 flu, it aggravated even more, and I think that just, there was a lot of not being prepared, and before we realized it with the diabetes as well as with the asthma as complications, as adding to the target group, and then with the influenza H1N1, it just culminated into worse symptoms and hospitalizations.
Dr. Markle, what's your take?
Well, I think that's a good point. What we're not finding is that the virus itself or the people themselves are more susceptible to the ravages of influenza. But there are these social or cultural circumstances that can make people more ill. And we do see a lot more asthma among inner city children, for example, because the air is a lot dirtier. And we also see a lot of children and adults, for that matter, who live in lower socioeconomic classes who don't have the same access to healthcare and doctors and nurses. So that means they may be coming to see the doctor at a much later course in their illness when they're far sicker.
We also hear that the parents' circumstances play a role in that it's harder it's harder for some parents to keep their kids home because they don't have sick leave.
Well,
they don't
absolutely.
Get,
what
work,
if you're a single parent? What if you're a single parent and you have an hourly job? You can't afford to take time off. There's all of these issues that are very important and that doctors have really learned over the last century or more that we really do have to pay attention. It's not just the microbe and the human being and the interaction that results. There's many social, cultural, physical, emotional, and you name it, aspects to a disease.
So Dr. Markle, why don't you pick, and Dr. Corder, I'll come to you next. What are there, what can public health officials do? They can't, you know, give parents sick leave. They can't necessarily make it easier for them to go to the doctor if they, or maybe they can, I don't know. So do you have some suggestions about what can be done to minimize these disparities or at least the impacts on these kids?
Well, there's a lot being discussed. One issue is, you're right, the public health official, him or herself, can't give a permission note to parents. But there was a bill in the House and the Senate that has not yet gone through that would make it easier for parents of sick children to stay at home. And that's something that we need to do a better job of. We also need to do a better job not just as public health workers and professionals but doctors and nurses and hospitals and the schools to make sure that our children get better health care. And so in a way, this influenza pandemic is really a microcosm of the health care discussion you were just discussing. So that if people have barriers to care or lack of access to care or their parents can't take them to see a doctor, bad stuff will happen.
Dr. Corder, what do you think? I mean, obviously, you're both a practitioner and a teacher and you work with a very diverse population of students. I mean, you can't sort of wave a wand and you know, get parents in to see you when they can't get off of work. What do you recommend?
I think it's very important that the education is out there. I believe the school would be a very good source of education in terms of not just kicking them out of the school, but to educate on the first day and each day after, hand out information if your child is having a runny nose, a fever, lethargic, you know, different things that they can begin to identify what's the alarm, you know, the alerts and the alarms that go out. And I agree with the other doctor in that it's very important to know that this is all related many times with stressors in that particular person's life, and there are times when they just not identifying or recognizing the significance of the signs and symptoms of the flu vaccine. So the teachers, of course, the doctors, and I think that, you know, the public health officials, when they vaccinate, when they, every chance and every opportunity that we can discuss and talk about the urgency and the importance of getting treatment and being monitored for flu-type symptoms.
And Dr. Markell, sort of on the flip side of this, you've both talked about the need to be sure parents are educated, to at least whatever tools are available, to give them access to the tools they need to address the issue. But Dr. Markell, a few months ago, you wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times expressing concern about scapegoating in times of epidemic. What's your biggest concern?
Well, this is one of my big scholarly concerns. When I write about the history of epidemics, I'm almost always drawn to the scapegoats. And you could look at almost every epidemic or pandemic in human history, and there's always some group that is blamed for the ills of the society. For example, a cholera pandemic in the 1890s was blamed on immigrating Russian Jews. More recently, with the H1N1 in the spring, first Mexicans and then Mexican immigrants were briefly scapegoated, particularly on cable television and opinion shows and so on. What we find, though, across history is that with influenza pandemics as opposed to other infectious epidemics is that these influenza pandemics are so widespread, they're so ubiquitous, and they spread so quickly around the world that there really isn't enough time to have a sustained scapegoating effort. That said, we have to be on guard about this because frequently those people who are scapegoated the most are groups that for some reason feel disenfranchised from the society to begin with.
Right.
So let's say it's undocumented immigrants who don't want to see a doctor. Well, that also laps over into documented immigrants. And then if those people aren't seeing a physician or a nurse or a health clinic for a contagious disease because they feel they'll be scapegoated or penalized for the disease, you have to ask very carefully, did that scapegoating help your public health or hinder it?
I think your point.
You can tell by the way I asked, it will hinder it.
Yeah, I can see your point. You seem to be saying that that one of the concerns is you focus more on these communities because you know they've been disproportionately affected in the past, and you're then concerned that it leads to a spotlight that inhibits the ability to get these groups into care. How do you address it? I don't know, Dr. Corder. How do you address that? Yeah.
Well, that's where the outreach is very important, and that's where wherever, as they say, no child left behind, no patient left behind, because it's very important. I agree, you know, there are times that they would be under the radar because of other, you know, political as well as social ills, but it's very important that as we try to control or study or even have some idea of the pandemic of anything, and, you know, the flu as well as illnesses in general, that the target groups are identified as well as that the entire population is looked at.
Dr. Markell, final thought from you. Are there particular steps you think public health officials should be taking now to minimize the impact of this disease, this fall?
Well, they're taking an enormous amount of efforts. If you look at the broad history of pandemic disease, never in the history of human beings have we planned so much before a pandemic has actually hit. So our planning is helping. And this didn't just start with H1N1. It has been going on for the last several years with avian flu as well. And none of these plans are mutually exclusive. We're doing a great job of getting vaccine online, but we have to do better. We need more vaccine faster. We also have to talk about these social issues that you're talking about on your show this morning, about underprivileged people. How are they going to get access to care? What about single moms or single dads who can't get their kids to care? And always be worried about scapegoating. You have to remember, germs are very egalitarian. They don't care really who they attack, just as long as they can find a body.
All right. We'll have to leave it there for now. Dr. Howard Markell is a professor of medical history at the University of Michigan and an advisor to the Centers for Disease Control on how to reach at-risk populations in case of a flu epidemic. Dr. Marilyn McPherson-Corder is a pediatrician and an associate professor of pediatrics in Washington, D.C. She's a frequent contributor to our parenting roundtable, The Moms, and she joined us on the phone from George Washington University Hospital. Dr. Markell is at WUOM in Ann Arbor. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.